Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Martin Schuster, who's going to be talking about how to measure a world. So welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Dave. It's great to be back.
This book, I guess, is a slight kind of departure from your last book, which was a kind of philosophy of television book. But it harks back to the first time we spoke, which was a book that was about kind of critical theory, Adorno. And I can see how this book, you know, sort of fits in with that broader sort of intellectual project. And I'm really interested to begin with the title. And I was kind of like intrigued, How to Measure a World. It's a fascinating title in itself. But I was also intrigued as to where the kind of project of measuring a world and how to measure a world came from.
Yeah, sure. So I think you're right to sort of see it growing out of some of my work in critical theory. I think there's a lot of critical theory in the book in a way, and it could also be referred to what I think people nowadays call critical phenomenology. So it's very much, I think, a book of phenomenology and connected to critical theory in certain ways, but also methodologically does something different than some of those books. And I'm sure we'll talk a little more about that. But the title really grew out of that. So much of phenomenology, you know, for listeners that might not be aware, it's essentially, it's a philosophical movement that roughly starts with a guy named Husserl. And the basic move is it's a descriptive study of structural features of experience. And maybe another way to put all of that in less technical jargon is it really tries to look at how things are given to us in the world. And so it starts with this basic idea that, you know, human consciousness is a unique phenomenon, and human consciousness is sort of defined by a feature, which is that it's always intentional, in Husserl's words, meaning that it is always consciousness of something. And then the idea is to study whether different kinds of conscious states can reveal certain things. And so imagine, like, consciousness of a work of art, for example, is different than consciousness of my body as I'm, you know, performing certain tasks or playing a sport, which is different from consciousness of when I'm thinking, which is different from consciousness of when I'm reading, and so forth and so forth. And you can see from those sort of examples that it's linked intimately to me, but also to the world. So phenomenology attempts to think about how it is that the world is revealed to human beings in distinction from other kinds of creatures. And so that's really where the title came from. In a lot of ways, it's very much inspired by this method, but also with a particular twist. So it has a historical dimension, but it's really, the subtitle is A Philosophy of Judaism. And so it attempts to give a sort of philosophical, phenomenological reading or approach to thinking about Judaism in these sort of terms, as oriented around thinking about the world.
And there's a, this sounds sort of slightly flippant, but, you know, there's a quite kind of stellar cast of, you know, sort of key Jewish thinkers. And it really does have a, you know, a very broad historical range. And one of the things that the book does is begins with Emmanuel Levinas, and he sort of appears repeatedly throughout the book and is a kind of key sort of touchstone, or, you know, sort of anchor point for the book's questions about how to measure a world. And I'm very interested into, you know, sort of why he was important. Was it, you know, were you kind of working on his thought generally and that kind of kicked off some of the ideas in the book, or you know, is he a key thinker that you think you know, we need to engage with if we're going to understand sort of how phenomenology might be important? What's his role in the text?
Right. So a little bit of both, actually. So in a way, I mean, you know, biographically, Levinas and all of these other post-World War II thinkers, sort of broadly conceived, were just always of interest to me. So as you mentioned, my first book was on Theodor W. Adorno. And I've published also on Hannah Arendt, on Jean Amaury. So all of these figures in this post-World War II sort of period. And they all are working around similar problems, which is to say they're thinking about how it is that something like the Nazi genocide was able to happen, which might not be, you know, a question that has the same sort of resonance for us now, but for, I think, you know, people in the European context, it had a particular resonance. And I think what's striking about all of them, and Levinas especially, is they realize very early on that it's not just a problem, let's say, about Nazi Germany, or it's not just a problem about this particular period, but rather it stretches far beyond this sort of historical period, both forwards, meaning that there are legacies and institutions and structures and features of the Nazi genocide that continue into even the present moment, I would argue, but also that there are features that precede the Nazi genocide that have to be taken into account. And so that's sort of the background for me biographically. But then Levinas himself, I think, phenomenologically, he's a very interesting figure in this tradition because he's sort of at the tail end of it. So if phenomenology begins with Husserl, then in a way, Levinas is the tail end of it because he's already a sort of critic of the tradition. And what I mean by that is he's someone who's radicalizing that method. So remember when I said that phenomenology is oriented around sort of intentionality or consciousness of something, then by the tail end of the tradition, you have figures like Heidegger, for example, who's also a well-known phenomenologist, and Levinas, who are both thinking about intentionality in ways that I think Husserl perhaps would be very uncomfortable with, meaning that they're thinking about consciousness of objects that do not ever appear, meaning Heidegger, for example, is thinking about death. And it seems like death has a profound effect on the sort of world we have, how we exist in it. And yet it's something that never appears, right? If we're dead, then there's no consciousness of anything. And Levinas is sort of very uncomfortable with both Heidegger's biographical story. So Heidegger was, a member of the Nazi Party, and Levinas is very much turned off, obviously, by the political commitments, but then also by his sort of focus on death and all of these sort of things, which he sees as intimately connected to his sort of adoption of Nazism. And Levinas is very much focused on things like the human encounter. So in the way that I am able to have a relationship with an other, that other also, Levinas wants to argue, never appears, in the sense that you cannot reduce the other person merely to what Levinas will call their plastic features. In other words, something like their particular physical characteristics. And obviously there's a lot more to say there, but the basic orientation I think is already very much pushing against the bounds of phenomenology, even as he's working with it there. And so all of these things together, and then on top of all of that, just to add very quickly a third thing, I mean, Levinas is also explicitly, he makes these remarks that, like, Judaism is an anachronism, he calls it. So he gives an essentialist definition of Judaism, which, you know, is already very controversial by this period. But it's a very odd one, and that leads him to make these sort of odd remarks that I talk about in the book sometimes, where he says, like, look, actually being Jewish is a modality of being human. And, like, you know, if we, if we end up on Mars and we find Martians, then actually a few of them will be Jewish also, because it's just a fundamental feature of being in the world. And so it's these odd sort of claims that tie the project of Judaism to this sort of phenomenological method that fascinated me, and I wanted to explore that. And then as I started working on this, I realized that something like this sort of approach or conception of Judaism can be diagnosed in a variety of figures, and that you could sort of construct a tradition around this. And so that's why the book moves, you know, backwards to figures like Maimonides, who's considered very much, you know, quote, traditional Jewish thinker, and then also forwards to figures like Adorno and Levinas and others.
And I guess it kind of interrogates this tradition or this project through two sort of broad clusters, really. And you say something right at the very end of the book about how, you know, the kind of the first couple of chapters, the first half, is about this question of like what it means to be in a world and how we should be kind of like orientated towards it. And there's, you know, wonder and outrage are two of the things you pick out in that conclusion. And then there's this kind of other half of the book, which is, well, you know, how do we actually construct worlds, you know, linguistically through experience and this kind of stuff. And I think we'll do sort of both of them in turn, and to not sort of box you in too much, because it'd be good to spend a bit of time on this. But Maimonides, you've mentioned, and this book he wrote, or this text, The Guide for the Perplexed, that I suppose is one way of sort of thinking about being in the world, which is about wondering and, you know, being kind of awed by it. And I was fascinated by that, both in terms of what that tells us about how to be in the world, but also for what would come later in terms of a very different approach that we see in Adorno.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a way, I think if I can speak at a very eagle's eye sort of view, like a high altitude view, they're both oriented by what we might call sort of negativity. And what I mean by that is there's a sort of negative relation to the world as it is. And so for Maimonides, he's someone who looks at the world, you know, again, as it is. So whatever we're considering at the present moment, or during his time period, whatever the case might be, but all the features, objects, people, and so forth of the world, Maimonides looking around and he's saying, look, you know, again, phenomenologically, I have this experience that there's something more than this, potentially. I just have some intuition. And, you know, he calls that God and so forth. But it's really, it starts in this phenomenological register where there's something existentially that Maimonides thinks that he registers. And I try to unpack that. And that's sort of where this motif of wonder comes in, is it, our wonder about the features of the world pushes us beyond the world. In other words, we have a sort of negative relation to it. And I don't mean that like sort of like it's negative, like, you know, we're depressed or something. It's negative in that it's negating the sort of features of the world as we encounter them. There's something more beyond that. And Adorno, in a way, is doing something very similar, again, at a very high altitude view, but he's negating the world because of a sort of moral outrage. Did he say, look, there has to be more than this, because it would be a sort of moral outrage if this was all that there was. And so they have, I think, formally analogous attitudes that both, again, take a negative relation to the world, but I'm almost loath to say reasons, because they operate not purely cognitively, but almost in this sort of bodily dimension, in a way. You sort of feel like there has to be more, either because you encounter the world in wonder or you encounter it in outrage. And once those two pieces were in place, then I realized that these are sort of, you know, limit cases in a way. They're just two fundamental ways of being in the world that it seemed to me cut across time and space. And I found that very fascinating. And then it was just a matter, like you said, of sort of developing some of these other aspects of what it means to have a world, meaning that, you know, it's defined by language and has a history and so forth and so forth.
I mean, one of the things you do, I should say, about the book is, you know, this is not just a sort of description of here is Maimonides, here is, you know, The Guide for the Perplexed, but you sort of put the work into dialogue through, I guess, a kind of phenomenological reading of the work. And you're interested in Islamic thoughts, you know, kind of classical Greek scholarship. We've already mentioned Heidegger. And I'm sort of keen to know how, I guess, you sort of take a text and put it into dialogue with kind of other forms of thought that go beyond, I guess, the kind of Jewish tradition. And in some ways, sort of, we've already alluded to this, are kind of, you know, radically opposed to it in particular ways.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So this was a feature that was very important to me, and for two sort of reasons. I mean, one was a deep sort of intellectual commitment that I talk about in a sense, but another was just a very pragmatic sort of feature, which is this grew out of actually a large grant that I was a PI on around religious understanding. And so it very much started as an inquiry into inter-religious dialogue, I guess is what people will call it. And so it was explicitly a way to frame inter-religious encounter. And so that was something that that's sort of how it grew out conceptually and how the work began in a way. But once I began sort of working on all of this and all of these figures, I realized that, to do them justice, you have to be able to engage all of these different sources. And so, the sort of Muslim milieu to Maimonides is sort of central, just as the German sort of milieu is central to Adorno, and, the French context is central to Levinas, and then all of them in different ways, I think, are engaging Judaic thought at different points. And so there are medieval motifs that appear here. And it was important to me just as a scholar to be able to bring these to the fore and to make sure that I can engage with these different sources responsibly. And so that became actually very important to me. And it's one of the features, just biographically, again, that I'm sort of most proud of the book, is that it's able to work across all of these sort of languages and sources, I think, in responsible ways. It's a feature of the book that I very much sort of wanted to be there so that it could be of interest to people that are working in those traditions, whether linguistic, religious, historical, whatever the case might be, and that they could find entry points into a work that they might not otherwise encounter necessarily, because it is in this way sort of eclectic and really doing something different from what any one of those traditions does by itself.
Yeah, actually, a really nice example of that is in the third chapter, where you put Adorno into dialogue with two thinkers that obviously he's very closely sort of associated with, but through the question of history. So you take Hegel and Marx and the idea of a kind of a universal history, and you sort of see how Adorno offers kind of critical or alternatives to that. And I suppose to kind of illustrate that dialogue, there's maybe a two-part question here. The first thing is, what is this idea of universal history? And then the second thing is, the kind of Adornian, is that a word? or Adorno's reading of that.
Yeah. So, there's a feature that emerges, I think, and it's very much a sort of Eurocentric approach that that emerges, I think, roughly in the early modern period. It has to do with the sort of encounter with the quote New World, right? The Americas, and we know that there's a strong genocidal element there and a deep problematic Eurocentrism, but there's a collection of sort of various philosophical approaches that emerges there to thinking about the sort of passage of history. And I think some of the dominant positions are something like the following, which is, Europe is the sort of the tail end of proper history. And it is the completion of a certain kind of project that, let's say, begins perhaps with the ancient Greeks and culminates in that Europe. And again, there's a lot of really horrible Eurocentric assumptions about the deficiency of indigenous cultures across the world, and also their lack of historicity, their lack of development, and so forth. It's multiple book projects to really tease out the full scope of that. So, my chapter is by no means conclusive, but I think what's interesting about Adorno and the other figure that's involved here is an associate of Adorno's of the Frankfurt School, Walter Benjamin. And I think what the two of them are responding to is there are versions of this that are triumphalist in the sense that they see a progressive passage to history, meaning that, things are getting progressively better and then they culminate in Europe. But then there are people who just reverse this direction and they say, look, there's a regressive history. And so things are getting worse. And you can think of, Rousseau is a very classic example of the latter. Things were going great in the state of nature. And then, we establish government and then everybody's in chains all of a sudden. And And I think what's interesting about Adorno and Benjamin is they find both of these problematic. They sort of highlight that they share a premise, and it is something that they attribute even to someone like Marx, who is considered, you know, a very radical thinker, and in many ways, of course, is extremely radical and someone we can still learn from an immense amount. But they diagnose a certain historical approach. And now I have to sort of add a caveat here. I'm not sure how true this actually is of the historical Marx, especially what we know now about the things that he's working on later in life and his approach to sort of non-European cultures and stuff. There's been work by people like Kevin Anderson in a book called Marx at the Margins, where this is really sketched. But be that as it may, the basic idea is that we want to reject both of these conceptions of history, whether progressive or regressive, because they both assume that history is homogenous in a certain way, meaning that it can be plotted in this way. And I think what Benjamin introduces to Adorno, what Adorno takes up in a certain way, is a rejection of this almost on ethical grounds, meaning that when you homogenize history in this way, then in a way, actually, you undermine the basic feature of history, which is that it involves humans, and humans are unique and unpredictable. And so there is always, they think, an element of deep contingency to anything. And that is true as much of the future as it is of the past, meaning how even history is constructed is by no means sort of something that happens, you know, by accident, or something that happens without further interference. And the historical record itself oftentimes forgets certain things that we can try to recover. You can tell stories of history that are non-contiguous in this way, that see history as not moving in linear terms, whether progressively or regressively, and so forth. And it seems very obvious to us now because we have a range of sort of scholars operating in this mode. But I think at the time that they were writing, this was a relatively radical proposal in this sort of European frame, and one that I think is very important, and that history since then has only borne out in the kinds of histories that we've done and started to do, and so forth. But just very, I know this is a very long answer, but just to add very quickly to that, what underwrites all of that, I think, for Benjamin is a manifestly sort of almost quasi-religious position about both the possibility of something like messianic redemption at any moment, just as a logical possibility, and also the sort of priority and uniqueness of every human life that cannot be just covered over by history in this sort of progressive or regressive way. And so there again, you have these sort of religious undercurrents that Benjamin pulls from Jewish tradition, but sort of reframes and repurposes in a different context towards a different end.
I mean, what you said actually struck me in terms of, you know, we still live actually with ideas of universal history, particularly in the progressive sense, but, you know, often linked really closely to sort of deeply regressive social political projects. And that I'm going to use as a bit of a sort of segue crudely into the way the book finishes. And one of the things that we see with the first kind of encounter with Adorno in the book is this idea about kind of suffering, but you raise, I guess, things that, you know, are about the kind of ethical orientation towards the world. And you come back to this, I guess, you know, more formally when you're thinking about kind of words, discourse, language, in how worlds are constructed. And I'm interested in, I guess, the kind of the place of ethics, not just in terms of how we construct worlds, but also the place of ethics within the book itself.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think you're absolutely right to diagnose that these sort of positions are still very much alive. And I think you can register them, you know, in the sort of shock that people, you know, that people sort of, I mean, mostly it seems like white people, at least in the US, expressed, you know, at the election of Trump, like, how could this happen? You know, and I think now, you know, you're experiencing something similar in Britain with the sort of the involvement of the Russian oligarchs in various features of British society. And it's sort of constant at every level that that I think there are these sort of accounts where things are seen as progressive. And so these striking emergences are seen as somehow anomalous. And I think people like Adorno and Benjamin look at it and they very much sympathize with the perspective of marginalized peoples who say, look, like actually this has been a constant. And that doesn't mean that history is then regressive, because again, that's just another sort of affirmation of the status quo, which is itself also problematic. And so again, the idea is really to deny both perspectives. And I think you're right to highlight that at bottom, there's a sort of ethical orientation for all of these figures that's linked deeply to what Judaism means for them. So when Levinas sort of suggests that Judaism is an anachronism, meaning that it pushes back against the current moment somehow, then that's really an ethical position. I mean, it claims that whatever is going presently is either morally wrong or it is, you know, something that leads us to wonder about other possibilities and so forth, but to explore more, which is a sort of ethical stance. So yeah, this is a fundamentally ethical position. And I think it's also operating under a distinct understanding of ethics that very much is inspired by Levinas. So I mentioned earlier that he was a sort of critic of phenomenology, and in a way, he's also a critic of the entire project of Western philosophy. And so he's very famous for saying, like, look, ethics is first philosophy. And so for the sort of dominant questions that are oftentimes understood by philosophers to have the most priority are questions of metaphysics or ontology, sort of what things are. And I think Levinas comes along, and here, this is something, again, he shares with Heidegger to a certain extent. And he says, look, these questions are actually not the ones that have the most priority. And Heidegger will give a particular answer for why he thinks that's the case. And Levinas gives a different answer. But essentially what Levinas wants to say is before you can begin asking any of these sort of questions about what something is you have to understand how a world comes about in the first place. So how is it that you have something rather than nothing? And notice that for humans, you know, obviously part of the answer is genetic, in the sense that we can point to the Big Bang and we can say, look, like, you know, obviously something had to happen and then things get going. But that doesn't get us a human world, which has so much more than just the sort of physical features, but rather has all of these intersubjective, normative, fundamentally human elements that can only be explained by the presence of intersubjectivity, other human beings, or again, what Levinas calls ethics, meaning relationships with other people. And so, yeah, that he thinks is the most fundamental basis of having a world in this human sense, that has to be considered if we're interested in doing philosophy. In other words, not just doing natural science where we're trying to understand how physically things came about, but if we're interested in doing philosophy and understanding how a human world, that a world, in other words, that makes room for consciousness, and that first person perspective, how that came about, then ethics has to be first philosophy, according to Levinas.
We should probably start to wrap up with Stanley Cavell, partially because his work, you know, is kind of crucial to that ethical discussion that forms the end of the book. But also, I sort of feel like we've kind of gone through the key names of each chapter, and it'd be, you know, slightly kind of unfair to sort of leave him out, given he has such a big role in that final chapter. So I think one route in might be actually if you could say a bit about kind of why he matters to the book, and again thinking about, you know, from where are we, sort of 11th, 12th century Jewish philosophy to something much more kind of contemporary.
Yeah, so again, I think the basic sort of move here is to see them as all bound up within one particular tradition that's oriented around seeing Judaism as an anachronism. In other words, Judaism as something that continually pushes against the world as it stands. And as I say that, to see Judaism also as a modality of being human, meaning that this is a capacity that all humans have in virtue of being human. And so, you know, we can reconstruct it around Jewish sources, but as you sort of highlighted, a lot of these figures are in dialogue with other traditions. And so potentially it could be reconstructed from other traditions as well. And so the idea is to use the religious archive in this sort of way. And I think, you know, Cavell is by no means a religious thinker in the sort of plain sense, but he's someone who's concerned with these sort of elements and features. And I think his thought takes on a particular cast if you can put him in a genealogy, let's say, that moves from Maimonides down to him, to Cavell. And I think where I find him sort of most productive and interesting is he's someone who is also thinking about things in ways very similar to Levinas, in that he's prioritizing this unique understanding of ethics, he's prioritizing intersubjectivity, our existence with others, but he's also highlighting a perpetual standing feature of that, which is that we can deny that. We can deny that we have connections to others. It can fail to register for us. We can fail to acknowledge people around us and that the world is constructed through those intersubjective relations. And the name he sort of gives to that is skepticism, broadly conceived. And again, this is another place where there's an established academic debate about skepticism. And then Cavell gives it a sort of almost axial twist where this established academic debate is linked to a fundamentally human existential problem that affects us as humans, as people who are capable of having these sort of relationships to others, but also by the same token are capable of denying them, ignoring them, avoiding them, failing to acknowledge them, and so forth. And it's important to understand that as also a perpetual standing feature of the world. And so that's sort of how Cavell fits into the overall overall project. Is it was important to understand why something like this tradition hasn't gained a lot of ground in what we might call normative Judaism, and how even Cavell himself lacks a certain sort of standing, I think, in philosophical circles. I mean, he's a well-respected figure, but in sort of traditional philosophical circles is oftentimes rarely taken seriously and hasn't had the sort of uptake that other figures have had from the 20th century.
I mean, it strikes me we've hit upon sort of three or four topics of discussion that easily could be books in themselves. You know, you sort of mentioned that in terms of history and, you know, a possible kind of reassessment of Cavell's work is there. Obviously, you know, you've already done a lot of work on Adorno. And I'm sort of intrigued to know where How to Measure a World kind of fits in terms of a future set of projects. Or, you know, is there a sense of, and again, you mentioned a sort of project grant that had helped some of the writing of the book. Is there a sense of this area of your thought kind of coming to a conclusion? Or is there more to be done kind of coming out of some of the ideas in this book?
Yeah, it's a great question. So in a way, I think there's two more things that I'm working on that I view as intimately connected to this, but that may not appear so intimately connected at first. And so I have two book projects that I'm sort of wrapping up now and trying to complete in different ways. One is a book called Genocide in the State. And the subtitle of that book is An Alternative History of Modern Political Philosophy. And the idea for the book is really to tell a story or tell the history of modern political philosophy from Hobbes to Hegel, not using something like, let's say, rights or freedom or sovereignty, so these classic sort of concepts, but rather using the concepts of genocide and the state and the relation between the two. So putting that into focus and seeing how the argument of the book is essentially that you can show that the genocidal impulse is a feature of the state concept as it's developed in Western philosophy from the very beginning, from Hobbes. And there's a much longer historical story here, I think, about how many of the modern philosophical concepts originate from geometry. And so there's always a drive for homogeneity that exists in political philosophy just because these concepts are ported from geometry and from a different discipline. And that's the sort of historical story. But that project is also very much a phenomenology project, because it's thinking about the phenomenology of the state. And so here, the method of sort of critical phenomenology is something that's very much animating my work also. And then the other book project is a very short book. Routledge has a series called The Basics, where it's sort of like an introduction to something that I'm doing, a book called Critical Theory, The Basics, that's a sort of introduction to the Frankfurt School, but that's attempting to tell the story of the Frankfurt School in a slightly different way than I think has been done frequently. So a lot of times, you know, people tell the story historically, or they will tell the story about the figures that were involved with the Frankfurt School. And I think you can actually tell a sort of story about the Frankfurt School conceptually, meaning that the entire impulse for the school originates from the desire to sort of alleviate, understand, and then alleviate human suffering. And I think you can see that impulse also in Marx already. And so I want to construct a history that proceeds conceptually in this way, that starts from something like, you know, what does it mean to acknowledge and respond to suffering in the world? What sort of concepts does that then require? So it requires certain notions of critique. And then you have to think about agency and sort of how agency is formed and how institutions work and so forth. And so to tell that sort of history, but to also do it in a way that highlights the extent to which Benjamin, for example, again, was very important to the school. And by means of Benjamin, all of these traditionally religious motifs that in a way Benjamin almost, that Adorno and Horkheimer and others inherit from Benjamin. So they're like the Jewish mystical tradition by means of Benjamin's engagement with the sort of scholar of Kabbalah, Gershom Scholem, is smuggled in a way. And so again, I think it's obvious how that in a way connects to the project here. But it's hard to say, you know, that they're like direct sequels, but they're very much circulating around similar themes methodologically and I think content-wise.